Greetings, brethren, and welcome to services today. This is a big day, the culmination of a feast. We had a great feast, I think. Everybody else agree? We had visitors from all the way across the country, from Pennsylvania to Michigan, Illinois, state of Washington, Arkansas, all coming because Yahweh has called out his people for this time. This is also the second day in the Omer count toward the Feast of Weeks. So as one ends, we march on to the next. Let's look at Leviticus 23, verse 15. And you shall count unto you from the morrow after the Sabbath, and that is the weekly Sabbath, 7676, from the day that you brought the sheaf of the wave offering, seven Sabbaths shall be complete. So we have two criteria here. Verse 16 says, even unto the morrow after the seventh Sabbath shall you number 50 days. 50 days. And you shall offer a new meat offering unto Yahweh. And that's where they get, of course, the word Pentecost. Penta meaning five or 50. I was talking to some brethren the other day here, and they were discussing a different doctrine that someone was trying to teach. I got a call from a man who said that we should only keep one Sabbath a month, and it starts on the new moon. But then I got to wondering, how's that going to work? How are you going to get 50 days and seven Sabbaths? That ain't going to work. Impossible. Also mentioned to him, you know, that Yahweh says work 6 days and rest the seventh. So some of these teachings just don't jive with the scriptures. And speaking of the scriptures, the feast is more than any other time, this feast especially, is a time to focus on our understanding of those scriptures and why we believe what we do. Paul used the term unleavened bread of sincerity and truth. As we mentioned before, when you hand out your unleavened bread, say, have some sincerity and truth. Because leavening is the opposite, insincerity and error. To have truth, you must have a truthful source. In John 17:17, remember this is Yahshua's prayer, and he said to his father about the people, sanctify them through your truth. Your word is truth. Your word is truth. His word is our truth as well. Because he's speaking not only of those people there, but people down through the aeons of time. His word is our truth, our standard for what we believe. But what if that word we have is not exactly perfect? What if it's been altered in critical areas by translators? What do we do? What if it's been compromised by editors with preconceived beliefs? Skewed by the differences in language and grammar between our language and two languages removed through the Greek or through the Latin and the Greek or the Hebrew, maybe three languages removed. And often it is misunderstood because it speaks from the mists of time where we've lost the meaning of many of its things, many of its what it speaks about, an archaic culture thousands of years ago. So how are we supposed to put all this together? How are we supposed to get truth? No translation done by any scholar or scholars, no matter how learned they are, is perfect. There is no perfect translation. Only the YIV is perfect, the Yahweh-inspired version. And sad to say, we don't have the most perfect, flawless first version because it is untranslated, unredacted, and original scriptures. So what we are faced with is a whole plethora of textual problems that get in our way when we try to learn truth or to tell others. You've all been in that situation. Somebody will point to a passage and they'll say, here's what it says, look at that. And then you got to explain that this was not the way it was inspired. It can't be because it doesn't fit with the rest of the scriptures. We don't have, sad to say, the most perfect, flawless version. So what we are faced with are lots of versions and problems that can get in our way if if we try to teach truth to others. We've got to be aware of the pitfalls so that we can ferret them out and distinguish them from the rest of Scriptures. First, we have to identify where those problems are in the Scriptures. And that's what I want to look at today. A few of those problem areas, textual anomalies that have led to doctrinal error and teaching down through the years, even so much so as that the largest church organization in the world is based on a lot of these errors. We'll focus on the King James Version, the standard on which most references are based. And I want to look at 2 Timothy 2:15 to begin. Here's an answer, one answer to how we're supposed to go about this. Paul was speaking to the young Timothy, and he said, "Study to show yourself approved unto Elohim." So we have to study. It isn't going to sink into us by osmosis. It's not going to drop out of the sky and a bunch of revelation that we can go out and teach. It's got to be studied. It's got to be rightly dividing, he says, the word of truth, because the workman then would not need to be ashamed. Here's one of the problems, one of the big obstacles to truth today, is having to look at the New Testament filtered through Greek rather than Hebrew eyes. We talk a lot about that. People who wrote, the apostles, were Hebrews. They spoke in an area and wrote in an area that was Hebraic, not Greek, as many would try to say. If you get a Greek text of the New Testament, and if you could read it, you'd find numerous Hebrew words in there that are spelled with Greek letters. Now, how did that go? How'd that happen? The names of many people are in the Hebrew. And other facts. Another would be is that most everything in the New Testament has a parallel in the Old Testament. So the Old Testament is the key to truth, and that's where we base our starting point, on the Old Testament. But nominal worship doesn't look at the Old Testament as authority, but only as a reference for living today. Pick out a few stories of a few people and get inspired by it, and that's about it, as far as it goes. Talk about David, talk about Moses, you know, a few of these. But the Old Testament is the key to truth. For most people, it has some good stories. It discusses good men. But in our time, how many of these people actually study it? How many people, and it's getting fewer and fewer today as well. The daily use of the Old Testament was a principal concern of the writers of the New Testament because they talked about it all the time. If you could write every passage down that refers to the Old Testament from the New Testament, you'd be surprised. Throughout the New Testament, the writers were basically arranging and commenting on common Hebraic knowledge as well as the law of Yahweh, and they showed us how to put into practice those laws and those principles that Yahweh put forth in that Old Testament. They actually showed us how to live those things. And I believe that's one of the reasons Joshua came when he did, because the hierarchy, the religious, those that controlled the religion of that day were manipulative and making things out of something that ain't, you know. So Joshua said, wait a minute. You're adding words, you're adding laws, wash, touch not, taste not, handle not, and all these things that are to perish with the using of just some examples. Well, we do not necessarily need, this is interesting, to have the New Testament to know Yahweh, do we? People in the Old Testament didn't have the New Testament. They knew Yahweh very well. Because under the inspiration of Yahweh's Spirit, we can draw from the Old Testament to know the fulfillment of Scripture the same way the writers of the New Testament did. They did the same thing. But the reverse, interestingly, is not true. And that is why those who focus entirely on the New Testament don't understand Yahweh or His complete will. You can't do it. It's not complete enough. From the Old Testament, we could almost completely compile another New Testament, minus, of course, some of the historical, or if not all the historical events. The New Testament gives us information from the Old Testament, doesn't it? as well as historical facts, cultural setting of the time. But from the New Testament alone, we cannot reassemble the Old Testament. It simply can't be done. We can guess at it. We can get some pretty good ideas, but we can't complete an Old Testament just going from the New. So the Old Testament, therefore, is the foundation of Yahweh's word. Throw it out, and you build a house on sand. There's no foundation. Okay, let's get into the language of the Bible. One of the central problems in translating Hebrew vis-a-vis Greek is the verb problem. Biblical Hebrew is noted for a relatively small vocabulary, entirely based on three-letter roots. They expanded on three-letter roots and added letters and made new words. So if you go back to Strong's, he'll show you the three-letter roots, if you go back to as close as you can to the original word. And there's only two verb tenses, what's called the perfect and the imperfect in Hebrew. And this causes big problems for translators in dealing with time. And combinations of perfect and imperfect were used to expand a range of descriptions and so forth. If you look at the two languages, Hebrew and Greek, you find that Hebrew is very pictorial. It paints lots of pictures, talks about a lot of just flowery language. It's very artistic, you might say. And Greek is not that way. And there's another problem. Greek is not that way. Hebrew doesn't have a past, present, and future like our language. I went to town yesterday. I'm going to town today. I will go to town tomorrow, past, present, and future. Hebrew doesn't have that. When the conjunction and, which is called the wa, is added, that's a verb construction. And when the conjunction and the wa are prefixed to the past perfect tense, it changes the meaning to future imperfect. And when it's prefixed to the future imperfect, it goes to past. Something we're completely not aware of in our language. Our language doesn't operate that way. Of course, you think that's complex. Take a look at the English language sometime. It's unbelievably complex, especially in its vocabulary. Hebrew thought says Yahweh spoke everything in the beginning, and it is either completed or being completed. Greek thought is just the opposite, which presents our first problem. In Greek, we have a tense of verbs called aorist, meaning non-defined. It derives from its tense from the Hebrew thought. Aorist comes from the past and is current in the present. So we get into giving an example here. Whenever it's read, that is, the present, and in the future, it will still be current. The first problem of tenses was solved by writing most of Hebrew in aorist tense, thereby retaining the Hebrew thought. For example, turn to Matthew chapter 6 and verse 12. Here is a definite issue in this verse. Matthew 6 and verse 12 says, Yahshua is speaking, and he says, "And lead us not into temptation, but deliver us from evil. For thine is the kingdom, the power, and the glory forever. Amen." Instead of "forgive us our debts as we forgive our debtors," the reading should be "as we also have forgiven our debtors." The thought being that when we ask in prayer to have forgiveness, we should already have had been forgiving others. Is that clear? Okay, that's one of the problems. And the aorist tense kind of gives us some difficulties there. There's all sorts of these things. And unless you're a scholar, wish I were, but there's all these things, and all we can do is look at the scholars and how did they interpret it. The second problem, as I mentioned, is Hebrew is very pictorial and realistic, while Greek is analytical and scientific. Why do they use all these Greek symbols in science? Brother Mike can probably tell you all about Greek and its use in the electronic field. All those symbols, because that's the kind of language it is. There was no simple way around this. The next step required translators to become very creative with classical Greek. They combined additional letters. As we talked about, bapto became baptizo to make a different meaning. and other ways they did that, and sometimes even other words to allow the Greek the same pictures. And when this was done, people of all lands could read the scriptures as it was intended in context and meaning. Here's an interesting fact. The Hebrew had 30,000 words in its vocabulary. 30,000. English has how many? 10 times that. 300,000 words. And that means one Hebrew word could be used in a dozen different ways. And the meaning was determined by the context. If you look in Strong's and you go back to try to figure out what's going on, it'll show you the usage of these words. Not only what the basic root means, but how it was translated. 14 times this way, 8 times that way, 3 times that way. Because it's determined by the context. It just isn't that precise. Each word was made up of, as I mentioned, three-letter roots in the Hebrew alphabet, and usually expressed some kind of activity or action. It's impossible to translate most Hebrew directly into modern English. Scholars come as close as they can with a lot of guessing, and that's another problem we face. New Testament Greek was far more complex than Hebrew. Greek has a 250,000 word vocabulary, almost as much as English. And a great variety of words developed to express shades of meaning. For instance, four different words for love in the Greek. Greek had many verb forms that don't exist in English. And Greek used in the New Testament is different from classical or modern Greek. We had a gentleman, you remember, to the feast last year, a man from Greece. And I asked him, can you read biblical Greek? He said, no. Huh. He said, it's changed. It's like trying to read Old English. It's almost like reading German, if you ever read Chaucer. It's just very difficult. I mean, he may pick off a word here or there, but it has changed. So there we go. I mean, you got to get your head into the old Greek mode before you can start to translate. One of the problems people have always had with the Old Testament is that it is pure Hebrew in thought. But the language of all Anglo-European thought and concepts is Greek. I'm sorry, but we live in a Greek culture. Your thinking is Greek more than Hebrew. The language of all English, European languages is Greek in its inflections and so forth. So here we have a New Testament based in Greek, written to convey Hebrew expressions and ideas, and we're looking at it from Greek eyes, basically. That's about as incompatible as it can get. Along come English translators to muddy the water further. The English Bible is not nearly as carefully translated as we have been led to believe. Yahweh gave us the inspired scriptures in the language he selected to communicate his word. And in our translations, we've created confusion. And there's lots of confusion. And Yahweh's not the author of confusion. So we rely on an abundance of translations. We go back to those older languages and try to figure it out for those problematic passages. Here's another problem. Why are there errors in the King James Version? And you've all seen them. Easter for Posh, Passover, and these other problems there. Text that isn't even in there, but it was added. Well, Protestant translators sometimes did not have access to all the Greek text. But here they are trying to translate the Greek. And being familiar with the Vulgate, they sometimes put words into their translations from the Latin. You'll find that. Bullinger brings a lot of those out, which were never there in the Greek and sometimes not even translatable from the Greek to the Hebrew. In about 80 places in the New Testament, the King James adopts Latin readings not found in the Greek. 80 different places. Erasmus had a corrupt, incomplete text of Revelation. And that's why in the King James there are mistakes in the book of Revelation. How about translation errors? Let's look at some translation errors in the King James. You're going to have to... I didn't have time. And I wasn't up to putting this on PowerPoint. I wish I had. Let's turn to Genesis chapter 10 and verse 9. You're going to have to read it. I hope you have a King James. It would help to demonstrate what I'm trying to say. But Genesis chapter 10 and verse 9 says, speaking of Nimrod, he was a mighty hunter before Yahweh. Wherefore it is said, even as Nimrod, the mighty hunter before Yahweh. He quotes it again as to substantiate. Well, the word before is not correct. And it gives the connotation that Nimrod was a good guy. He was a mighty hunter before Yahweh, and Yahweh praised him, you know. That's not what it's talking about at all. Not at all. It's anything but true. Actually, what that word before means, before Yahweh, meaning in opposition to Yahweh. He was a bad guy. But the scripture doesn't tell us that, does it? Like it should. It just kind of leaves it pretty vague, and everybody thinks, oh, he's a mighty hunter. Anybody that's a mighty hunter has got to be a good guy. Very talented and so forth. Leviticus 16:8. Let's go over there. This is one that's coming up. We talked about the Feast of Weeks. Leviticus 16:8, and Moses said, this shall be, and I'm in Exodus 16:8. Hang on, sticky pages. Leviticus 16:8 reads, and Aaron shall cast lots upon the two goats, one lot for Yahweh and the other for the scapegoat. Why did they use that term, scapegoat, in the King James? It has the connotation of someone who has been unjustly blamed for somebody else's sins. Make him the scapegoat, you know. Throw your transgression on him. That's not what it's talking about. Someone who's unjustly blamed. Of course, the Hebrew is Azazel, and it means one removed or separated. Whole different meaning comes out of there, doesn't it? The Azazel goat, I believe, represents Satan. He's taken out into the wilderness, and he wanders the earth, you know. Who is? Not a scapegoat, certainly. He is guilty of what he's done. He's guilty of his part in our sins. So, very bad translation. Let's go to Deuteronomy chapter 23. There's so many of these. I just went through a few, but maybe someday we could even have a study on it. Deuteronomy chapter 23, verse 17. And I think it's appropriate that we do this on Unleavened Bread because that's what we're doing. We're examining our beliefs and how they've been impacted by translation or not impacted. Deuteronomy 23, 17. There shall be no whore of the daughters of Israel, nor a Sodomite of the sons of Israel. I see a parallel there, but it's not in the translation, is it? There was no word for homosexual in the Bible. There was no word for homosexual S. So they just translated it whore. It should have been lesbian, because that fits then with the rest of the context. Nor a Sodomite of the sons of Israel. So you couldn't allow that in Israel. We allow it in our culture today, don't we? Don't think anything of it. Deuteronomy 24:1. When a man has taken a wife and married her, and it come to pass that she find no favor in his eyes because he has found some uncleanness in her, then let him write a bill of divorcement and give it in her hand and send her out of his house. Then, then let him write her a bill of divorcement. That wasn't how it read. It should read, and he. It's not a command to do that. Moses isn't saying, write her a bill of divorcement, get rid of her. He says, no. Then, find no favor in his eyes because he's found some cleanness in her. Then, or and he, write her a bill of divorcement and give it in her hand and set her out of the house. See that the thought is not completed. But it sounds like Moses is commanding it, and he's not. As Joshua explained in Matthew 19, Moses didn't command anything anyway, did he? He passed on Yahweh's laws to the people. It just became known as Moses' law because guess who handed them to the people but Moses himself. But he wasn't making law. He was not a legislator. This statute says it happened because of the hardness of their hearts. Okay? A little nuance there, but makes a big difference. Let's turn to Ezekiel chapter 20. Ezekiel chapter 20, I look at verse 25. Wherefore I gave them also statutes that were not good. What? And judgments whereby they should not live. What? What in the world? Yahweh's given them statutes that aren't good? There's some hanky-panky going on here. Something's not right. Ezekiel 20:25, which is a mistranslation, again, because we know that Yahweh's laws are good, don't we? Perfect and right. Well, what this really showing is that since Israel rejected Yahweh's laws, he allowed them to hurt themselves by following false man-made customs and laws. Wherefore, I gave them also over to statutes that are not good, and judgments whereby they should not live. Notice, and I polluted them in their own gifts, in that they caused to pass through the fire all that opened the womb. See, this is, of course, the what Ahaz did to the firstborn, so forth, learning it from all those Moloch worshipers. So there's the example. We're talking about their beliefs, not Yahweh's. Keep that in mind. That's why I always, when I have a problem with a passage, get another version and look at it. Then, if it still gives you a problem, and it may, then get out the Hebrew, the Greek. Get out a word study and see just what is it. I don't know how many issues we've solved in our Bible studies by looking at the original as close as we can get. It really, I mean, you can't get to the source unless you go to the source. Okay, let's jump to the New Testament. Here's where we have lots of fun. Matthew 5:48. Matthew 5:48. I had a man question me. He says, aren't we supposed to be perfect? I said, well, yeah, it would sure be great. No, I mean, aren't we supposed to be perfect? Because I guess he thought he was. Let's look at verse 48. Be ye therefore perfect, even as your Father which is in heaven is perfect, he read. Well, if you look at the Greek, it says become therefore. And perfect means whole, complete, or mature. Sanctification is a process of overcoming, and it takes time. You don't wake up one morning and be sanctified, as some believe. You know, you repeat a few words and now you're saved. And there's nothing you can do to escape that, no matter if you don't want to or not. Yahweh's going to save you, which is not true. Hebrews 6 tells us that. But it should be become, therefore. It's a process. Justification, yes, that's something different. That's standing before Yahweh completely sinless, and that's where you are after immersion. But sanctification means a setting apart. We get the word holy from that. And that's what we're talking about. That is the process of overcoming with the help of the Holy Spirit. Matthew 28, verse 1. This, of course, is in context of the Passover. 28, verse 1. In the end of the Sabbath, as it began to dawn toward the first day of the week, came Mary Magdalene and the other Mary to see the sepulchre. What are you thinking here? Same thing churchianity's thinking. Early Sunday morning, we're talking about dawn, we're talking about first day of the week. What else could it be? Well, translated literally, here's what it could be. Now, late on the Sabbath, as it was getting dusk toward the first day of the week. Oh, there's a different teaching here, I see. But they mistranslated because they were locked into the Sunday, you know, resurrection thing. So they made it fit. Twisted a little bit. It was a little bit creative with the Greek. John chapter 13. John chapter 13, Luke, John 13. All right. This one's very interesting. Very interesting. 13 verse 2. And supper, this is talking about the Passover, being ended, the devil, having now put into the heart of Judas Iscariot, Simon's son, to betray him. Other translations have it and during supper, that's the RSV, rather than and supper being ended. But even better is Alford's translation. He says, supper having been served. Now what follows was the foot washing, which makes complete sense that you wash before you eat. Doesn't it? And then Peter was all confused. Oh, you're just washing my feet. Yasha was trying to make a point. You know, he didn't put him in the shower. He said, you're clean, but you've got a problem here. You've got a man here who's a big problem. So I'll demonstrate that by just washing part, your feet. This meal was a Passover memorial, not a separate part like the Seder. It was the Passover, if you look into the Greek. Hebrews chapter 4, verse 9. Okay, here's where people say, there's no Sabbath in the New Testament. The Sabbath has been done away. And you look at Hebrews 4, 9, in the right eyes, and it says, there remains therefore a rest to the people of Yahweh. A rest. There remains therefore a keeping of the Sabbath, if you look at the Greek. A keeping of the Sabbath. How plain can that be? Rest is sabbatismos, and according to the KJV, New Testament Greek lexicon, it is from sabbaton, meaning seventh day. It's related to the Hebrew word for Sabbath. So there it is. There's the command in the New Testament, keep the Sabbath. Put that in your memory bank. Hebrews 4, 9. Well, for a real botch job, let's go to 1 John 5. Remember, Yahweh's word is true and righteous altogether, but man, having tinkered with it, has given us something less than pure. So we've got to know where those problem areas are. 1 John 5, 7. For there are three that bear record in heaven, the Father, the Word, and the Holy Ghost, and these three are one. And there are three that bear witness in earth, the Spirit and the water and the blood. And these three agree in one. So there's the Trinity doctrine for most teachings right there in black and white. The italicized words, if you've got a King James, no, it's not kept italicized in mine either. But the italicized words in heaven, the Father, the Word, and the Holy Spirit, and these three are one, and there are three that bear witness in earth. What does italics mean? It was added, wasn't it? It was an added text. The italicized words are from the Vulgate Latin text. How about that? And were added to the original to support the Trinity doctrine. It wasn't in any version of the Bible before the 16th century. You can't find it. Go back and look for it. If you have an old Bible, you're not going to find it. It was added from the Latin. Why? By the church, of course, for its teachings. Sometimes italics are good, sometimes there's something wrong with them. You see, no language can be translated word for word from one language to another. You can't do it. Hebrew and Greek idioms often do not come through clearly into literal English. Thus, beginning in 1560 with the Geneva Bible, translators initiated the practice of adding italicized words to try to make the original language more plain. The 54 King James translators did the same thing. That's why the King James has a lot of italicized words. Trying to make it clear. Sometimes they do. They have a little help word. Sometimes they don't. Sometimes because of their doctrinal misunderstanding, they add error instead of truth to the text. In Psalm chapter 81, verse 4. Let's look at that. I know this can be a little technical, but I think maybe we can expand our thinking a little bit. Our horizons, Psalm 81, verse 4. For this was a statute. This psalm is talking about the Feast of Trumpets, Song of Asaph. The new moon. It says, blow up the trumpet in the new moon, in the time appointed on our solemn feast day. For this was a statute for Israel and a law of the Elohim of Jacob. So if you have a It says was. Actually, this was. That was added. It should read for, a statute for Israel, and a law, the Elohim of Jacob. You see, new moons are still a statute of Yahweh. And it is like describing to a newspaper reporter today about how society keeps the July 4th holiday. And you say, the 4th of July was a holiday they kept instead of a holiday they keep, which makes a lot more sense, right? Present tense, they're still keeping it. And that's what that should have been here. So that got twisted and mangled. And then we go on to Colossians 2:16, one of the big ones, about the Sabbath. People will point to this one all the time. So let's get a handle on it. Colossians 2:16 and 17. And you're going to understand it properly only if we take out the italicized word. Let no man, therefore, judge you in meat or in drink or in the respect of a holy day or of the new moon or of the Sabbath day. Okay, let no man, that means just any old man. Maybe he doesn't even keep these things. That's what it's talking about. Which are a shadow of things to come, but the body of Messiah. Okay, that word is. Take that word is out of there and it makes perfect sense. It is was added. Let no man do it, but let the body of Messiah do it. Why? Because they're keeping these days. Makes perfect sense. Don't let man judge you as doing wrong when you observe the holy days, new moons, and Sabbaths. Let the body of Messiah do the judging. Punctuation problems. You ever looked at, they had that display in Kansas City of the Dead Sea Scrolls. I didn't get to go, but I have seen the scrolls. And it's all jumbled together. The words are all stuck together. You don't see any sentence beginnings. You don't see periods. You don't see punctuation. You don't see any of that. The Hebrew just goes, you don't see capital letters either. It's hard to tell where you're starting and stopping. And so they had to add these things. Sometimes they added them correctly. Sometimes they didn't. Luke chapter 23:43. Yahshua said unto them, verily I say unto you, today shall you be with me in paradise. Did he say he's going to be there in paradise that day? Don't think so, because Yahshua wasn't even there. Yahshua went to the tomb, didn't he? There's a problem there. If the italicized word is taken out, if the comma is put in the right place, then it makes a lot more sense. I'm telling you, today, you shall be with me in paradise. And that's as common. We do that too. I'm telling you right now. You know, that's an emphatic. Because Yahshua didn't go that day. We know that. So something is amiss. Something is rotten in Greece. Punctuation. Watch it. Sometimes it'll throw you. The Greek didn't have punctuation marks as we do today either. So here you go. The King James was an attempt to make it clear on how these translations were to go. And so they did the best they could. And man, did they have a uphill climb, didn't they? Trying to jive what they thought the Bible said with what they're already teaching. Like some brother was telling me, he said his dad is a strong leader in a nominal church. And he says, I try to explain things to him. He turns around and puts it in context of what he's been told. So that involves a little twisting, you know, square peg in the round hole. You have to do that, or it's not going to fit. You can't just take it at face value. You got to spin it. Okay. Let's look at Mark chapter 16 and verse 9. 16 and verse 9. This is another one regarding the resurrection. People look at this and say he was resurrected on the first day of the week. Now when Yahshua was risen early the first day of the week, he appeared first to Mary Magdalene, out of whom he had cast seven devils. All right, We have a punctuation anomaly here, don't we? A real problem. It doesn't say he was resurrected on Sunday morning. There's a missing implied comma between risen and early. When Yahshua's risen, comma, pause, new thought, early, the first day of the week, he appeared first to Mary Magdalene. That makes very much sense because it jives with the rest of the text. Should be a comma there. Word differences. Another thing to keep in mind is the fact that the 1611 King James Bible is somewhat different from today's English language, of course, and the meaning of certain words has changed. There's all sorts of funny words they use in there, don't they? That's what a lot of people don't like to use it. They want to use the New King James, get rid of these and thous and some of the other words that are in there they don't understand. So they have to realize that, you know, languages are alive. They change through time. And they're adding all the time more words. We see that today. And even faster today through communication, through instant news and all of that. Somebody can just start to, who was it, Al Gore and his carbon? It's not carbon or something. His global warming thing. Everything now is carbonate or carbon. And he never heard that before he made his speech. But now you do. Or lending practices. They come up with all sorts of little idiomatic expressions and so forth. Subprime and all that. And what are you talking about? Anyway, that's language. And it does change. It does grow. But it's different in the Bible than it is today. And the meaning of certain words has changed. And the King James uses words that are not familiar to people in common speech. And certain idioms in the Hebrew and Greek are a little difficult to understand today. There's a book called the Oxford Wide Margin King James Version. And it's supposed to have excellent marginal references, which often explain, I'd sure like to get one of these, correct meanings. Here's a partial list of changed word meanings. And hang on, we're almost done. Hell. It says there are three Greek words rendered hell in the New Testament. Gehenna, Hades, equivalent, of course, to the Hebrew Sheol, used in the Old Testament. And Tartaru. Gehenna is the lake of fire, Hades is the grave, and Tartaru is the abyss of restraint for fallen angels. For English-speaking people during the time of the King James, hell, or Hades, was a cellar to put potatoes in, not a lake of burning brimstone. In Acts chapter 2, as long as we're in Acts, I'm still there. Chapter 2 and verse 27. Chapter 2 and 27. Let's see what that could be. Because you will not leave my soul in hell, neither will you suffer your Holy One to see corruption. So we're talking about the grave. The grave. Don't leave my soul in the grave. While Matthew 10:28. And Mark 9:43-48, hell means the lake of fire. Of course, the word Tartarus is only used one time in 2 Peter 2. So you've got to realize that different words were translated in different ways. And if they had really done their homework, they would have realized that, and we wouldn't have some of these doctrines of ever-burning hellfire and so forth, because it would have been a different word. You don't have fire going in the grave. Spiritually mature, as you find in 2 Timothy 3:17. Wish I had put this on PowerPoint now, but we would have been wearing that machine out if I had. 2 Timothy 3:17 says that the man of Elohim may be perfect, thoroughly furnished unto all good works. The man of Elohim may be perfect. Furnished, thoroughly furnished, spiritually mature is what it's talking about. Because nobody is perfect. No man is without sin, we find. Perfect, upright, or sincere. Genesis 17:1 translates that in the Hebrew. We also know that prophecy or prophesy means to not only tell a future, but more often it means inspired teaching. Someone prophesies in my name, you know, he can be teaching. Like 1 Corinthians 14. Well, Yahweh says that we are to rightly divide His word. And this takes knowledge. It's not something that's going to happen overnight. It's going to take lots of study, a lot of effort, a lot of leading of His Spirit. At the beginning of the feast, I asked somebody, why is it that folks in the Sacred Name movement seem to be so strong-willed about their beliefs? I mean, it's got to be that way and no other way. Why is that? Is it because the Sacred Name attracts these kind of people? Or is it because we've been encouraging them all along to study, 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 study? So they have been. And look what they came up with. But it was flawed. There's a lot of independents out there that are studying on their own. And, you know, you need something, someone to bounce these things off of. You can get way off on a tangent if not. You have to have somebody say, wait a minute, have you ever thought of this? No. And you pull back a little bit. So it's very important that we use the knowledge of other brethren as we study, and that's what we do in Bible studies, because it's easy to get so far off that you can come up with all sorts of strange teachings, and they're there. Just get on the internet and you'll find them. So I hope this has been helpful to you, and may Yahweh bless us as we go on now to Pentecost, Feast of Weeks, and prepare for that time and all the meaning that it has for us as we finish out this feast and think of all the good things we did and learned here, and hopefully see you all next time. May Yahweh bless you.